Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, and welcome also to listeners from New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I recently spoke with Roger Hart about his new book, The Chinese Roots of Linear Algebra, that came out with the Hopkins University Press in 2011. Now, this is a book that is going to be required reading for anybody interested in the history of science, certainly the history of mathematics in China, but it's also a book that represents an extraordinarily broad-ranging commentary on many of the really important issues that we struggle with and questions that we struggle with as historians or scholars trying to make sense of what it might look like to do something like the global history of science or mathematics. So in addition to being an amazing achievement just simply for the kinds of skills and expertise that Hart brings to this project, just an amazing facility with very difficult Chinese mathematical texts, but also a facility for understanding, thinking through, and making accessible linear algebra in history and in practice. It's a book that also speaks to issues of interdisciplinarity. It speaks to issues of how to understand practice with respect to the kind of textual documents that we have as historians. It's a book that speaks to a number of different issues, and we had a really interesting conversation about it that I hope you will enjoy. Hello, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. We're here today to talk with Roger Hart about his recent book, The Chinese Roots of Linear Algebra, that came out with the Johns Hopkins University Press in 2011. Now, Roger and I have been talking a little bit about this, but I want to just kind of state again something I've already said, which is this is an amazing book. It's an amazing achievement that's founded on what's really a staggering expertise in both Sinology and mathematics, which is an exceptionally rare combination of kinds of expertise to bring to bear in a project. And it's really going to be on the list of classic texts in the history of Chinese science, if it's not already, for many years to come. So first, Roger, congratulations, because it's an amazing achievement. And thank you, secondly, for being with us today and for making the time.
Oh, you're far too kind, and I tremendously appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
My pleasure. So, Roger, could you start us off a little bit by kind of going broad scope and talking a little bit about what brought you into the field of Chinese science and Chinese mathematics in particular in the first place? Why Chinese science? Why China in particular as well?
Would you like to hear the very short answer, the short answer, or the longer answer?
Whatever you'd like, whatever you'd like. If you've never given the longer answer, maybe this is a great place to do it.
Okay, well, I'll try to be fairly brief. I went into mathematics because I was very interested in philosophy. And as you know, in the Western tradition, from the Greeks to Descartes to Leibniz up to Russell, Wittgenstein, etc., there's a long history of philosophers focusing on mathematics. By the time I was in grad school, I realized that mathematics and philosophy no longer had a whole lot to do with each other, especially in the reactions of my professors in mathematics, who were not terribly interested in philosophy. So when I had an opportunity to go to China, I went there for 1 year, I thought. My Chinese was not fluent after the first year, so I stayed another and another and eventually stayed 5 years. And when I came back to the U.S., my Chinese was as good as my math, and I was much more interested in that. So then I went into grad school in Chinese studies and eventually stumbled on the introduction of Euclid's Elements into China. And that gave me a way to use my background in mathematics, my background in Chinese studies. But more importantly, I viewed this at the time as a way to understand the interaction between Western science and Western mathematics and Western reason and traditional Chinese thought. This initial understanding turned out to be completely wrong, but that's how I got involved in this whole project.
And this is a project that started, I'll phrase it as a question. Can you talk a little bit about the change in shape of the project from where it first began? And this was part of research that you did for your dissertation.
Yes.
Right? So can you talk, because a lot of our listeners are interested, and I'm also interested in hearing about this process of transforming your work from the point of dissertation research into what it becomes ultimately. Can you talk about how those transformations in the context of this book in particular?
Yes. I think so many of us do, when we begin formulating our dissertation research, it's a combination of looking at secondary research, looking at theoretical frameworks and primary sources. And so when I began looking at Euclid's Elements in China, there were two very important works, one by Jacques Genet about incommensurability, and also Jean-Claude Martzloff looked at Euclid's Elements and argued that the Chinese did not understand its deductive structure because of an incommensurability between Western languages and Chinese. So my initial formulation of this whole project was to look at incommensurability, but to argue that their view of incommensurability was not adequately, it wasn't precise enough. So I wanted to look at incommensurability between different kinds of languages, different kinds of social structures, and different kinds of scientific thought. But as I looked more into this, is, you know, we then usually turn our focus more to primary sources. And the primary sources led me in a completely different direction. So in the end, I jettisoned this entire framework of incommensurability. And, you know, sort of to make a long story short, in the end, I realized that this focus on Euclid's Elements in China was really a misdirection. It was not something of considerable importance. And the primary sources, the Chinese primary sources, led me to see that.
It's so interesting, just kind of tangentially. I just recently also spoke with Avner Ben-Zaken, who also recently published a book, and who also was very concerned with the idea of incommensurability. And it's interesting to think about how those of us who look at or who have looked at the history of the exchange or transmission or circulation or movement of science among cultures engage either explicitly or, you know, implicitly in terms of thinking about the genesis of our projects with this idea of incommensurability. This itself could, I think, be an interesting historiographical project, a sort of meta project.
I was just this summer, I was at a conference on the 50th anniversary of incommensurability. This was held I guess there were may have been several of these, but this one was at Taiwan National University. And it was a very interesting experience because there still are people who argue for incommensurability, even though I think by this point the evidence against it is, from my point of view at least, pretty overwhelming.
Right. Now, you just mentioned it in describing what led you, or one of the things that led you into the shape of the project as it currently stands. You talked about an early investigation into Euclid's Elements in China. And this is also something that you mentioned in the preface. So this is In short, you mentioned that inquiry into linear algebra began with the investigation into the intro of Euclid's Elements into your investigation in China in 1607 by Matteo Ricci and Xu Guangqi. And I mention this because this allows us to talk about one of the major themes that comes up at the beginning of the book and that continues to come up later on, which is that Xu argued that Chinese mathematics was in a state of decline. And you say that you became increasingly skeptical of this claim. This is this theme of the decline narrative of Chinese math is something that you do respond to in the book. Can you talk about that a little bit for our listeners and sort of maybe how you think about this problem in the context of the larger historiography of Chinese mathematics or Chinese science?
Thank you. Yes, that is material that I focus more on in the book that's now forthcoming, Imagined Civilizations, China, the West, and the First Encounter. So as you know, that book will be out in late 2012.
We'll look forward to it.
Well, thank you. So that's where I really address the problems of the historiography more. But the assumption has been that mathematics during the Ming Dynasty, this is the 17th century, the assumption has been that Chinese mathematics flourished around the 14th and 15th centuries, and then it fell into decline by the 17th century, and that the introduction of Western mathematics by a group of scholar officials who translated Jesuit materials. The assumption has been that they created a kind of renaissance of interest in science. And in fact, this figure Xu Guangqi that you talk about has been asserted to be a convert. It's been asserted that he found Western science compelling and therefore accepted Ricci's Catholic doctrines and converted to Catholicism. He's been asserted to be China's greatest polymath. A recent 2008 conference in his commemoration of his work called him China's greatest polymath. And as I started looking at this material, it struck me that this mathematics was fairly rudimentary, fairly basic. And so he called all of Chinese mathematics during his period, he called it tattered sandals. And his idea was that we could discard all of Chinese mathematics and adopt the mathematics that he was translating from the Jesuits and adopt Western learning. And his point really was he was a high official, and his point was that he should be put in charge of astronomy and military matters and other projects. And the reason that he should be put in charge is because Western learning was superior and he was here to help, right? mathematics actually plays a very interesting role, I think, in evaluating these claims, because was Xu Guangqi this, Chinese official, was he really great at agriculture and water conservancy and astronomy and mathematics and all of these things, military matters? Or was he, like other officials of the period, presenting memorials to the throne on things that he really had very little expertise on? As I looked into the mathematics, it became clear to me that he had very little expertise in Chinese mathematics, and we can document this. So, you know, was he a great military leader? That's sort of hard to go back and assess because we can't be there. Were they correct in their predictions of eclipses? That's also hard to assess. It's a very difficult question. Is he an expert in mathematics? That we have documents on. That can demonstrate. And the point of one of the points of my second book is that not only were his statements about Chinese mathematics false, he clearly knew that because he purloined problems from Chinese mathematical texts, and they included them in books that made it seem that they were translated from Western sources. And in particular, this is linear algebra. So what's interesting to me, and as you know, this sort of follows up on Carlo Ginzburg's discussion of the Morellian method, where an art historian looks at things that are seem insignificant, but like ears. But by looking at the ears very closely, then we can see what's authentic, what's a forgery. You know, these are things that someone wouldn't necessarily pay a lot of attention to doctoring or to altering. And we can use clues from this in order to try to take a more critical perspective on history. So the problem has been that Xu Guangqi pronounced that Chinese mathematics was in decline and Western mathematics was in every way superior. And later historians have accepted Xu Guangqi's views as historical fact. In other words, they've just repeated what Xu Guangqi said. But when we look at the documents, we can see that actually linear algebra was quite developed at this time in China. They recognized it as something that was very important, and so important that they purloined problems from Chinese linear algebra in order to make the argument that Western mathematics was in every way superior.
Now, this is really interesting, and it's interesting in the context also of a historiographical point that you bring up later in the book, and I'll just mention here, which is that this is the study that you take us through and that we'll go through in the next hour or so is really evidence that we ought to be more critical about how, in thinking about authorship and expertise, about how much we're believing the claims of literati about their own expertise and their own role in developing these kinds of sophisticated mathematical techniques that you take us through in the book, which, as we'll talk about, may not have had much to do, or that's not fair, that's not necessarily fair, but the right way to understand the kinds of techniques you're going to be showing us is not necessarily from the context of literati texts on Chinese mathematics.
Right? Yes, yes. Very much agree with your point of view that Li Shijun is a collector. These people are all collectors, and I think that's a very important insight. Yes.
So one of the things that you mention, there are many really interesting historiographical and methodological contributions that this book makes, in addition to being a very, very detailed and carefully worked out treatment of a particular kinds of problems in linear algebra. But one of the central theses of the book, as you presented to us, actually speaks to something you very briefly mentioned, which is in your mention of clues and the ear and sort of painting and visuality. One of the things that you're arguing here is that visualization, okay, so to sort of step from that, was extraordinarily important to the solution of linear algebra problems. And this is in the context in particular of this imperial Chinese mathematical history, as you bring it here, but perhaps more broadly as well. So can you say a little bit about this? Because this point about visualization and visuality seems to have much broader implications potentially than simply for this kind of problem. And I think it's really interesting for scholars of STS, for example, more generally.
Yes. Well, this was one of the last things that I realized in writing the book, but I my own feeling is it's one of the most important. And that is, when I began to look at this problem, I conflated texts and practice. And I think that's very common in our field. We talk about practice, but as historians, we value texts. Mm-hmm. And so we try to read the text, try to understand the text, work very hard to track down all of the references and to get the translation right and stuff like that. But as I was nearing completion of this book, I realized that the text, these mathematical treatises only preserve traces of the mathematical practices. So it's like the tip of an iceberg. You see the tip, and you don't want to mistake that for the whole iceberg. That could be fatal, right? So what I found in looking at these mathematical problems is that the mathematical problems were solved on a two-dimensional counting board, and they were solved using very, very simple patterns. And once you understand the pattern, you apply it again and again and again, almost mechanically. And the remarkable thing is that you can solve extraordinarily difficult problems in linear algebra, which is in equations, in unknowns. You can solve these very difficult problems just by following these simple patterns, if you know addition and subtraction and division and a little bit about fractions. So this does not require literacy. This is very simple practice that you can be trained in. And I realized that to translate this two-dimensional visual practice into one-dimensional narrative, and especially one-dimensional classical Chinese. So to turn this into a one-dimensional story makes it intelligible. So the in the case of linear algebra, these practices have to be transmitted by showing people how to solve the problems on the counting board. And the records of these practices in classical Chinese, if you are not already expert in the practice, you can't possibly understand what the text is saying. So one of the sort of implications for this is that, well, then why are people recording this? And in the Chinese case, and I think arguably also in the European case, early modern European texts, these texts were often used for purposes of patronage, to gain patronage, or displays of knowledge. They're not... We don't want to confuse the historical archive, these texts, with the world. They give us evidence about the world, but the world practice is so much broader than what is preserved in these texts.
That's great. And this is actually something that I wanted to ask you about as well. This issue of practice versus text. I think this is one of the really insightful contributions that this book makes. And I think this is one of the reasons why I really recommend listeners who may not have any background or any specific interest, even really, in the history of mathematics, to look through this book. Because even if readers can't follow every step along the way of every single one of the reconstructions of the practices. If you pick up an art history book, you're not necessarily, as somebody untrained in the practice of reading a painting, going to be able to follow every single move that a trained art historian is going to make in each of the detailed chapters. But you do have then a resource for understanding that practice when you need it. And I think the book itself that you've given us is about much more than just these particular practices. And this is one of the ways, both the point about the importance of visualization, but also the related broader historiographical point about practice and this relationship to text. I think this is something that all of us could use more critical reflection on. And this is one of the great contributions of the book, I think.
Well, thank you. I think, you know, many people are moving towards a focus on practice, and it's, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit difficult to sort of flesh out what that means. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is extremely important for us to go from, as historians, from this focus on texts. And if you think about it, the focus on texts has also led to a kind of hagiographic focus, mm-hmm. because we focus on the text, and then we, as historians, sort of naturally attribute to that text a priority in discovering these things. Mm-hmm. And then very quickly, we're writing a historiography, a hagiography of our, the person we're looking at. And what has become very clear to me from the mathematical evidence in Chinese sources is that the people recording this, they're kind of ethnographers. They're recording what they see, but they're not experts. They don't understand much more than sort of the basics. And there's considerable evidence that the practices are considerably more sophisticated than our ethnographers tell us. And so one of the sort of mistakes I think we've made as historians of science is, and I mentioned this phrase in my book, is that we give credit to those who claimed it for themselves. So the person who records these practices takes it to the imperial court, says to the court, if you want to order the empire, you must know about these linear algebra practices that I have recorded for you. We tend to then, he's seeking credit in court, and we tend to give credit to him as being one of the great mathematicians in Chinese history. And the evidence from linear algebra is that that's not true. They're recording things. They're bringing it to court. They certainly have some understanding of these practices, but they're not the ones who are doing the very difficult calculations.
And this actually brings us right into another thing I wanted to make sure to talk about, which is the practices themselves, right? So let's get right into it. And don't worry, I'll keep this relatively broad, but let's, you know, I think we can get into some detail. So one of the central concepts in the book and the term for these practices that we've talked about is fengcheng. Yeah. And you say that fengcheng has been translated before as matrices or rectangular arrays. Because this is such a central focus of the book, can you say a little bit about fengcheng? What is that? For someone who may not know anything about mathematics, what's fengcheng? How do they understand that?
Okay, well, I'll back up and say a little bit about linear algebra. That linear algebra, is one of the two or three main courses at the advanced high school or the beginning undergraduate level. So there's calculus, linear algebra, differential equations. Those are often, you know, the three main courses. And so what linear algebra does is you are given in equations where n can be any number from 1 up to whatever. You're given in equations, and you're also given in equations in unknowns. And it turns out that those problems will usually have a solution. One way to solve them is a method that has been called Gaussian elimination. And so that is a method where you eliminate entries in this matrix, this n by n array of numbers. You use certain procedures to eliminate entries to wind up with a solution for the nth unknown. And then you use what is called back substitution to find the solution to all n unknowns. So in other words, if you have 3 equations and 3 unknowns, using Gaussian elimination, you can eliminate various entries to find the solution to the third unknown. You use the third unknown to find the second unknown. You use the second and third unknown to find the first unknown. So you found all 3 unknowns. There's another method called determinants. And that involves multiplications of entries, not elimination of entries, but multiplication of entries. Determinants is a more complicated method that really requires either a very small matrix or else a matrix with a lot of zeros. And so as I explain in my book, as the matrix gets larger, the computation becomes impossibly difficult. So Gaussian elimination is what has been called the most important matrix algorithm in modern day linear algebra. Gaussian elimination is the best way to solve these, and determinants is an interesting alternative that turns out to be very complicated. Now, what I found in my book is that it's long been known that there are records of a procedure for solving matrices, for solving linear equations, that is similar to Gaussian elimination, that is recorded in the earliest transmitted text in Chinese mathematics. So the earliest Chinese classic in mathematics has an entire chapter on what we would today call linear algebra. The title to that chapter is Fangcheng, the word I use in my book to describe it. And what I'm trying to get across is that these methods are really identical, essentially speaking. And so the way that the Chinese lay out a matrix and the way we do it today is identical, except the Chinese write from top to bottom and right to left. We write from left to right and top to bottom. So the orientation of the matrix is turned, but the matrix is written in exactly what we call the form of an augmented matrix today. What we today call Gaussian elimination, the elimination procedure in the 9 chapters, and this is from about 100 AD in China. The elimination procedure is exactly one form of what we today call Gaussian elimination. It turns out that they have a method of back substitution that is a little bit more sophisticated than what we use today. And I won't get into this, but the reason that they're using a more sophisticated method is they want to avoid fractions. They want to avoid, they have a matrix, a rectangular array of n by n or n plus 1 by n, numbers on accounting board, and fractions would require that you use you put two numbers in the place that they have for one. So you can see that they're already using their two dimensions, mm-hmm. and were they to try to put fractions into this, they'd have a mess. So basically, again, Gaussian elimination is found in the nine chapters from 100 AD in China, and that's been known. What has been assumed about this is that there was no connection between China and what is called the West. So it's been assumed that Gauss discovered Gaussian elimination. And then in 2011, I believe, an important article came out in Historia Mathematica arguing that it was Newton, Isaac Newton, that discovered Gaussian elimination. And that and the title of this paper is very interesting. It's a very good paper. It's how ordinary elimination became Gaussian elimination. So the idea is that Newton used this method, and then later this method circulates in Europe, and finally Gauss's name becomes attached to this. Mm-hmm. Again, Gaussian elimination is the single most important matrix algorithm for this very, very important subject, which is linear algebra. It's almost the equal of calculus. Okay. Right. Now, so to sort of go back, if you understand a little bit about linear algebra, then you sort of understand what they were doing in China, because it's the same. The assumption has been, and it's an assumption that remains in my book. The assumption has been that Chinese linear algebra may not have influenced Western work in linear algebra. Mm-hmm. So in my book, in the conclusion, what I state is that Leibniz and Gauss were not the first to discover these methods. Mm-hmm. And at the time that the book was published, that was all that I felt that I could say with proof that we were historians, which is documentary proof, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, I suspected that this might have circulated. It seemed logical that it might have circulated. But as historians, you know, and this is something where my view is now changing as I shift more to practice. Mm-hmm. As a historian, I wanted to find documentary evidence that the matrices that the Chinese were working on wound up. And I'd looked at a lot of sources. I'd come up empty-handed. I'd emailed experts in European linear algebra, and they said, no, we haven't seen those. And so in the end, I put the most distinctive Chinese linear algebra problem as the cover of my book. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have a copy that has the cover.
I do.
Yeah. So that question is taken in nine unknowns, mm-hmm. and it's filled with zeros. Mm-hmm. If you look at it, it's mostly zeros, and you have a main diagonal, mm-hmm. entries along what is sometimes called the super diagonal. Mm-hmm. And the key thing is that you also have one entry in the upper left-hand corner.
Right.
So all the rest of this is zeros except the two diagonals, mm-hmm. and entry in the corner. Mm-hmm. And these matrices of this form matrices in dozens of Western mathematical texts, modern texts. Mm-hmm. So thousands of matrices. I found one, 3x3, that was similar to this. One out of thousands, 10,000, I'm not sure. So it's very hesitant, not having this documentary evidence to say that these methods from China were found up in the West. And a lot of the reason is because we have this China-West dichotomy.
Right.
First, from the view that science is Western from the early 20th century, Peter criticizes it from the point of view of China has science. And so he sets up this horse race. China versus the West. And he calls his entire series, to which we're all so tremendously indebted, he calls it Science and Civilization in China. So the, one of the main problems here in my own thinking was, despite all the criticisms that I have gone through about China and the West, I still, in some sense, accepted this. Now, so having found it in China, I was reticent to say that this is what we see in Europe. About maybe 6 months, 8 months after this was published, I made a very interesting find, and that was that problems of this sort that are on the cover I found in Fibonacci. So is that, in fact, these are practices that are circulating throughout Eurasia.
Right.
Think about it. It makes perfect sense. You don't have to be literate. You don't have to, memorize the four books of Juzhu, the five Confucian classics, in order to do this. Travelers or traders, people who interact with other cultures, can demonstrate this game. Quite an extraordinary trick to say that we have five equations in five unknowns. Can you give me the answer? Okay. It's absolutely extraordinary that solutions exist, but to teach this and to transmit this, you don't have to have a book going from one place to another. You have someone showing how to do this on a counting board. And if you are competent enough in mathematics to trade with other groups, you probably have the competence to learn this mathematical trick. So, but what I can say with some certainty is that these problems that I describe in my book on Chinese linear algebra are so distinctive that they can serve as a kind of fingerprint. Hmm. They're so unusual. They're so bizarre, almost, that they can serve as a kind of fingerprint. And when I found these recorded in Fibonacci, then I knew that this was a practice that had circulated throughout Eurasia. And then on rare occasions, you have like Fibonacci recording this, or you have one in China recording this. But it's a much broader practice that people record, very rarely, but it gives us that tip of an iceberg to see that there's a lot more going on during the period.
And one of the really fascinating things about this is that it was speaking to an interest in not just holding sort of China and the West dichotomy here. I mean, one of the things that I think you do really well in this book in particular is to help undermine that to some extent, also by showing through this study of Fang Cheng practices that this is also a way for us to start being a little bit more careful about how we think about popular versus elite mathematics, right? That this wasn't just, I mean, people who don't know much about this field might come to this and have a very totalizing view of Chinese mathematics as if this all looks one way, it's all done in one context. Yeah. And one of the interesting things about Fang Cheng practice and practitioners is something that you've mentioned. I mean, you mentioned you don't have to be literate to be able to do this, right? And in fact, we don't know much about, I mean, I could ask you, for listeners who might be interested in, you know, who are these Fang Cheng practitioners? We don't know much about them, right? So we don't know who was training in this, who was using this. But what we do, what we can say a little bit about through this, and what you have said a little bit about through this, is the way that this might speak to understanding the relationship between elite and popular mathematics in China, right? And so, yes. Can you say a little bit about that in the context of this? And I ask for a number of reasons. One, because this issue of tracing practices and literacy seems very much to sort of to raise this, but also because many of the examples of the problems that you give us and readers who might work through the text or those who might not work through all of the details of all of those chapters will realize or should realize that the examples are very what we might call practical, right? These are examples like, how do you measure the amount of grain coming out of a certain, you know, dimensions of a field of rice? How do you measure the length of a well? You mentioned that Fang Cheng as a term comes up largely in its most early forms, perhaps, in the context of taxation. And so this is another set of really interesting issues, I think, that the book speaks to. So can you speak to some aspect of this?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Those are very interesting questions and very helpful. The first, and this is a view that I'm still in the middle of trying to digest myself, but what became clear to me after writing this is that the people that we have, again, worshipped as the great Chinese mathematicians were only the people whose names were attached to texts that had been preserved by the court. So that is what we've called the elite mathematicians. These people who are very well trained in Confucianism, and they're the problems that they record, I can see that the methods that they are using are not the best methods that a practitioner would have used. That they're recording things, they're doing them in sort of the most elementary way, when in fact the problem itself, like this problem that's on my cover, has a very special solution that we have a record for, but almost none of the authors that we have record the specialized solution. They all record the simple solution. So what we've looked at in the Chinese case and identified as the elite are in fact not the people who were the adepts at solving this. And, you know, it makes sense. If you think of someone spending, you know, a substantial portion of their life trying to calculate numbers on this, arrays of numbers on this counting board and finding special methods and stuff, it's likely that such a person is not going to be a high official in court and vice versa. If you're a high official in court, you're not going to spend all of your time with this board game. And if you're spending all of this time with your board game, you probably cannot become a high official, right? So, but more generally speaking, I think that the people who are developing science in the period before the scientific revolution are not people who are necessarily writing about it. So I think that we've really, in some sense, misdirected our focus again on texts and the people who produce them, instead of focusing on the practices that turn out to be incredibly important as linear algebra is now. Now, one thing I do want to suggest, though, about this linear algebra is, in my view, this was likely essentially a game. It is something for which I have found no practical applications. And so what happens is actually very fascinating, that problems that are pretextual, problems that are all made up, problems that you would never solve using linear algebra, are given this facade of practicality when they're recorded in words to be presented to the court. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the people who are sort of the middlemen, the people who are ethnographers who are recording this and getting credit for it, they're trying to persuade the court that this actually is important and practical. When, you know, for the period I study, I really have not yet found a practical application for this. So, to give you a very simple example, and this is one of my favorite examples, it's the well problem. So it's a version of the problem that is on the cover of my book, but it's five equations and five unknowns. And I'll try to explain this quickly, but it's what we would now call five equations in five unknowns. And the problem goes like this. There are five families, and each family has ropes of a different length. So A has ropes of the length of A's ropes. B has several ropes, all the same, but the length of B, C, etc. And so the problem is set up like this. Two of A's ropes plus one of B's ropes reaches the depth, the unknown depth of a well. Then three of B's ropes plus one of C's ropes reaches this bottom of a well of unknown depth. Then four of D and one of E and et cetera. So you have five equations, and in this case, you actually have six unknowns because the depth of the well is not unknown. Now, you can't solve that in linear algebra. And so what they do is they suddenly say the depth the well is 721. How did they get that? Well, in my book, I explain that what they're actually doing is using a determinantal calculation. So they're multiplying these diagonals, and they're adding the one in the corner, and they wind up with what today we would call a determinant. And what does that do for them? What it does for them is that if in their problem, the depth of the well is not zero, there will always be a solution to their problem. So one of the complexities of linear algebra is you can have five equations in five unknowns and have no solution. And I won't get into the reasons for that. But the way they set up the well problem, if their well has a depth, there will always be a solution. So in any case, to go back to this well problem, the well problem is sort of the exemplar of these sort of bizarre problems they're doing. It's what I call this fingerprint, the thing I find in Fibonacci. And one of the keys is it's in equations and n plus one unknowns, and they find the n plus one unknown by determinantal method. And this is, we don't do this today. I mean, there are no such problems in equations in n plus one unknown. So in any case, this is a very distinctive problem, but it's absolutely impractical. Mm-hmm. five families with ropes of unknown length and a well of unknown depth, what do? You measure your ropes, right? And then you put the ropes down the well, you measure the well, okay? You would not take your ropes and combine them, two of A's, one of B, happens to reach the well of unknown depth. Three of B's, one of C's happens to reach this. Great. Now we're going to use linear algebra to solve five equations in five unknowns to determine the depth of the well and the length of the ropes. It's absurd. But much of the mathematics during this period when it's recorded, in these word problems that seem, in some sense, to be practical. But when we look at them closely, we say, no, you know, that's an entirely fabricated. It's textual. And so of 18 problems in the nine chapters, in this Fengcheng chapter, chapter 8, of the 18 problems, there is not a single problem there that has practical implications. Any of those problems you would solve in a very different way. You would never use linear algebra to solve those problems.
So why this veneer of practicality? Sort of why choose that particular kind of rhetoric?
Present to the court. Uh-huh. And if you look at the prefaces to many of these mathematical treatises, it's extraordinary. They're saying to the emperor, if you want to order all under heaven, mm-hmm. you need to know this mathematical practice. Mm-hmm. There's a very interesting phenomena of people presenting practices, whether it's astronomy or medicine, is offered to the court to order the state. So if you look at the inner classic of the Yellow Lord, the Huangdi, Nei Jing, if you look at that and you look at the preface and you look at many of the passages, explicitly that through this kind of politicized medicine, that the state will be ordered in the same way medicine is ordered. Mm-hmm. If you look at the record of music, the Yue Ji, it states explicitly that the order of government is the order of music. Mm-hmm. So there's always the attempt to convince the court, to persuade the court that music or medicine or philology, the shapes of characters, or mathematics or astronomy, all of these are going to help the emperor order all under heaven. And that's why they're being presented.
Well, Roger, we have taken up a lot of your time, and there's much more in the book that we didn't have a chance to get to. And for listeners, I mean, each one of these concepts that we've been talking about, including determinantal style solutions and Fengcheng problems, and these are all worked out in extraordinary detail with particular examples provided in the book. And so listeners can consult those chapters and find a very detailed explication of all of these kinds of concepts. And in a work that I think we've already shown in the course of this discussion has broad ramifications beyond simply the field of Chinese mathematics, even though it's also clearly a banner publication in that field as well. So Roger, is there anything in particular that you want to make clear for listeners who may not have had a chance to read the book? Anything about the book that we didn't have a chance to cover that you want to put out there for listeners?
Yes, maybe just very briefly. When I look back at the work, what I think is most interesting is, hopefully, its broader implications, that the contributions that have created something like linear algebra, which is now really, really important. This has happened in very chance ways, in very surprising ways, over hundreds of years, probably thousands or 10,000s of people playing an odd board game that seemed at the time, you know, to have a very different significance. And then today we find this one of our most important sort of mathematical results. Mm-hmm. I think what it points to is that in looking at the history of science before the scientific revolution, that if we concentrate on practices rather than the alleged great scientists of the past, that we'll shift away from this view of civilizations and elites as having provided to us, sort of magically almost, these techniques. We'll see that actually this was the result of a tremendous amount of work in places that people didn't know what to expect and weren't necessarily shooting for, creating modern mathematics, but accidentally did so. So I think that when we look back at the history of science, we're going to see a lot more chance, a lot less teleology, mm-hmm. A lot less genius, and a lot more practices being circulated and combined in ways that are completely fortuitous.
Now, we've already mentioned that you've also got another book coming out just this year, 2012, and so we'll eagerly look forward to that. And because you've said a little bit about that, I'm not going to close by asking you to say too much more about that. Okay. But I will put a link to that on the site when this goes up. Instead, I'm going to ask you if we can close by going at this end of our conversation to the beginning, of the book. And the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you have a really lovely quotation from Ludwig Wittgenstein's remarks on the foundations of mathematics. And this is maybe a good place for us to sort of collect this together and then point outward. Imagine the geometry of four-dimensional space, says Wittgenstein, done with a view to learning about the living conditions of spirits. Does this mean that it is not mathematics? This is a wonderful quote. Can we close by saying a little bit about this? How does this speak to the general themes of the work for you now? And also maybe as we look forward to what's to come from you and your future work?
Okay. Well, as I mentioned when we were chatting before the interview, in this book, I did not discuss sort of the theoretical background of my work, but I do think that that's very important. And one of the things that many scholars in the late 20th century, I think, emphasized, and I think it's very, very important, is a critical approach and also a kind of genealogical approach where we understand that something that plays a certain role within one context may be doing something very different in another context. So this book is titled Chinese Roots of Linear Algebra. And I'm very grateful to the editor of, or the chief editor of Johns Hopkins University, who proposed that title as sort of a pun. Roots is a mathematical term, but also it suggests that, there may be the beginnings of linear algebra in China. And it turns out that actually that's true, or that, this was a Eurasian practice. But I also, in accepting that title, roots meant something else for me. And as you know, roots, there's another metaphor for roots, not the tree, but the rhizome. And I think that's a very nice metaphor for the way I see these linear algebra practices, that they develop in one context and one environment, and then they shoot off into another environment and become something quite different for quite different purposes. So I think that as, and I'm only a small part of this larger movement, I think, that, of course, you and many others are part of. But I think that as we begin to look more closely at the history of science, we begin to see very interesting discontinuities and very interesting changes in things that were completely unexpected when we began to look at our sources. So we began to look at our projects with a received just-so narrative, a grand narrative. We look back at the primary sources, and we suddenly find things are completely different than what we were told. So I think that's the task of the historian, and I think that that will have important implications for our understanding of not just science, but society in general.
Well, Roger, thank you so much. It's an amazing book. It's an extraordinary accomplishment, and we'll look forward to reading the next one, and perhaps we can talk about that one too when it comes out.
Okay. So. Well, I tremendously appreciate your taking the time, and it was wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time.